Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The economic words of the day today are repatriation, settlement, and nerd. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 19th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We take a page from the Department of Commerce as our starting point today. The page in a report out this morning that says American companies repatriated just shy of $170 billion in the second quarter. That is money held overseas, lured back into this country by the sharply lower tax rates on repatriated profits in the GOP tax bill of late last year. And it is coming back, that money. A lot of it, just nowhere near the amounts promised. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The president said in August he expected more than $4 trillion in overseas corporate profits to come flowing into the U.S. very soon.
$4 trillion? That's completely unrealistic.
Michaela Morrow is associate professor of accounting at Suffolk University. A more reality-based number to aim for might be closer to $2.5 trillion, according to the Tax Foundation. Still, so far in the first half of the year, the Commerce Department says about 20% of that, or $465 billion, has come into the U.S.
Those are very large numbers, and they represent a significant fraction of what profits overseas have been.
Mihir Desai is a professor at Harvard Law School. He says the money could be coming back a little faster, though.
The law was very hastily written. So there has been a great deal of confusion over the way these things actually work, and the regulations haven't even been finalized.
But also, all that money, those trillions that U.S. companies have earned abroad, it's not all sitting in vaults somewhere.
A lot of it was in plants and equipment. It's not actually things that companies can move back.
Nicole Kading is with the Tax Foundation.
Companies bought other companies overseas. They made investments there.
Secondly, U.S. companies aren't just thinking about taxes when they keep money overseas, says Suffolk's Michaela Morrow.
They're also considering things like, what's my supply chain? Where's my customer? What's my labor cost in another country?
And companies bringing money to the U.S. will need a reason for doing so. Maybe an investment or a strategy to use the money here. And those may take time to find. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today in tariff land, we are at T-5 because come Monday, almost 6,000 line items will be added to the list of Chinese imports upon which the White House has imposed import taxes. That'll likely mean higher prices for leather handbags and fruit juice and rain jackets. Like I said, 6,000 new items. And inevitably, on a list that big, there are going to be some surprises. Surprises for American consumers, yes. Also surprises, though, for the people running American factories. Because in the world in which we live, of super complex global supply chains, manufacturers don't always know what's in their own products. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one from Washington.
The dirty little secret is that lots of factories don't know their own supply chains, says Willie Shi at Harvard Business School. Global car makers learned the hard way 7 years ago, he says. A deadly tsunami knocked out Japanese factories, including one that every brand depended on.
There was this material that goes into automotive paint that makes black and red sparkly. Okay, and there was a sole source factory there. When that went out, then all of a sudden you couldn't paint your car black anymore.
Here's the problem. A CEO might know her supplier and her supplier's supplier, but beyond that, she says, probably not. There's the same invisibility with China and tariffs. Companies with complicated supply chains don't know exactly what's from China and may be surprised when the prices of those things go up. Rosemary Coates is a customs broker, and she's executive director of the Reshoring Institute.
What component parts of the product are Chinese, for example? What component parts might be Korean or Taiwanese or Malaysian? You know, it's really hard to know that. So they're going to get stuck unknowing.
And the unknowing will turn up in sectors that surprise people, says Willie Shi. Pharmaceutical firms source key compounds from China. Then there's vitamins, packaged food.
People don't realize how many components or food products come from China. we export fish caught in the North Atlantic to China for processing, and then it comes back.
The supply chain surprises won't just hit the manufacturers. In most cases, they'll pass along the tariff sticker shock to you and me. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, once again, it's like the trade war's not even happening at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Much time has been spent on this program this year looking backward at 2008 and the 10 years that followed, the causes and the effects of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. Today, we're going to jump just about into the middle of the past decade to the settlements some of those big banks agreed to pay for some of the things they had done in the lead up to the financial crisis. Shoddy mortgage lending, deceptive loan practices, you know the drill. By one estimate, those banks have coughed up $250 billion tied to the housing market meltdown. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has been tracking one of those settlements, the biggest, actually, to find out where the money went.
August 2014, Attorney General Eric Holder walks to a podium flanked by nine government officials in dark suits.
The Department of Justice has reached an agreement with Bank of America totaling over $16.6 billion in penalties and consumer relief.
Bank of America agreed to this record fine to settle lawsuits and investigations into how it and companies it bought, like Countrywide, had issued mortgages, packaged them together, and sold those bundles to investors. Those mortgage-backed securities, remember that term? They were riskier than the banks made them out to be.
This constitutes the largest civil settlement with a single entity in history.
About half the total settlement went to the federal government, mostly to fund general operations. Then, six states involved in the settlement shared another billion or so dollars. California and Illinois, for example, gave money to state pension funds that had invested in these mortgage-backed securities. New York set up programs to counsel homeowners and tear down vacant homes. And then the third place the money went was to consumers. About $7 billion was designated for consumer relief. Things like
modifying mortgages, providing money for neighborhood stabilization, foreclosure prevention, legal assistance, and affordable rental housing.
Eric Green is a lawyer in Boston and the independent monitor for this settlement. The agreement also included some incentives. If the bank funded certain programs or got the money out quickly, it could reduce its overall bill. That means the headline $7 billion number is a little misleading.
Do you have a sense on what that actually means in dollar values for the bank?
It wouldn't surprise me if it was less than $5 billion in actual cost.
Green says in the end, the bank modified about 90,000 mortgages to help people stay in their homes. It provided financing for 5,000 affordable housing units across the country. It even donated about 1,500 homes.
So I think you're talking about maybe 150,000 people total would benefit in some way.
Which sounds both like a lot and not that much at the same time.
I agree. As big as this program was, and this was the largest program of its kind, in a sense, it's still insufficient for the harm caused by the mortgage crisis and the bursting of the housing bubble.
Bank of America didn't want to talk for this story. And all these years later, figuring out what the settlement cost the bank and how much impact that money had, it's really tricky. Tom Perelli was previously the Associate Attorney General at the Justice Department and is now the independent monitor for a similar but smaller settlement with Citigroup.
I think there are a lot of questions about how much of this was win-win, how much of this would banks have done anyway.
Like modifying mortgages or donating distressed properties. Both can have benefits for the bank. For consumers, Perelli says one part of the settlement stands out, financing affordable housing. One of those projects, Bank of America contributed $4 million to an apartment building under construction in the Bronx. For that, the bank got about $15 million of settlement credit.
The housing market is getting really, really difficult in all the five boroughs, and it's becoming even more increasingly difficult here in the Bronx.
Social worker Michael DeBerry is hoping he and his wife might qualify for one of those new apartments that rent at below market rates. The settlement money helped pay for extras, like a gym and solar panels.
It's a fresh look. It's a welcoming look. The amenities, I'm sure, are nice and brand new and, you know, vermin-free.
10 years after the financial crisis, 4 years after this settlement was announced, this building in the Bronx is almost done. Tenants will likely start moving in the next month. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The White House said this week it's going to cut the number of refugees allowed into this country. 30,000 will be the new cap. That's down from 45,000 this year and well below historical averages. Thing is, there are places in this country that depend on refugees, that have built their economies in a way on that labor pool. Erie, Pennsylvania is one of those places, a city that had to do something as its population shrank and jobs disappeared. We met Delana Graysinger, the director of the International Institute in Erie. It does refugee resettlement during a reporting trip there about a year and a half or so ago. So we called her back up today to talk about this whole thing. Delana, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
We talked a lot, actually, when we were in Erie a year and a half, 2 years ago, about the impact that refugees have had on that city. It's an economic asset to that city, the refugee population, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of the strategic planning that's gone into looking at how the city can grow has been around refugee resettlement and bringing folks in.
So what's happening now that refugees aren't coming in the numbers they used to come in?
Yeah, it's definitely a slower number. Here in Erie, we've got landlords that aren't able to fill houses and employers that are just kind of waiting to see, do they grow a production line? Do they shrink a production line? We can't keep up with the demand that folks are asking us to because we don't have the arrivals.
Can you feel it walking around town? Can you see it?
So Erie is a really great community and is an extremely supportive of what we do. So I think that they've really stepped up and have tried to showcase the contributions that refugees are bringing to the city. So there's that positive feel, but that's happening because we know the negative side of it.
This is also a business model problem for you, right, at the International Institute?
It is, yeah. Even though we're a nonprofit, we're still a business. So, we have to figure out how to keep the lights on and people in place, for sure.
What are you laying people off? You cutting hours? What are you doing?
No, we started over a year ago when we thought this might be happening, really trying to diversify funding and making sure that we could shore things up. So we're holding on here, which is good news.
A word about some of the folks who are there who are using your services. Are they able to reach their families at home? And what sense do you have of sort of the mood that they are in?
Well, what clients tell us is they're worried. So, it definitely creates a lot of unnecessary anxiety on whether they'll be reunited with family members. And it gets hard when you have elderly family members who may be sick. You may not see them again. And that's really where people are at. So,
what do you suppose happens in Erie if the refugee numbers are limited even farther?
Well, it's going to be interesting because, as I said, a lot of the strategic growth is around refugees coming in. And so if you don't have those numbers, I think the city is going to have to rethink where is that growth coming from, because we don't have other growth areas. The city is going to have to look long and hard at what that means.
Delana Graysinger, she's the executive director of the International Institute in Erie, Pennsylvania. Delana, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Coming up.
It got forwarded to a few friends. They forwarded it to a few more friends, and that's kind of how it started.
And then a couple of forwards after that, it's a multi-million dollar business. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 158 today, 0.6%, 26,405. NASDAQ subtracted 6 points. less than a 10th percent, 79.50. S&P 500 up 3, 10th percent, 29.07. Bloomberg reported that Amazon is considering a plan to open 3,000 cashierless stores in the next couple of years. Shares of Target dropped a 0.5% on that news. Kroger down 1.3%. Amazon down 0.7% today. Delta Airlines is joining two rivals in raising fees on checked bags. First bag will cost you 30 instead of 25. Second, 40 instead of 35. Delta shares, they'll cost you a 10th percent higher today. AutoNation rose 1.9% on news that CEO Mike Jackson is stepping down. He has led the country's largest auto dealership chain for almost two decades. Reviews for the $400 Apple Watch are rolling in. The new one, whiz-bang, is a fair summary. It goes on sale on Friday. Apple shares, they didn't care, stood pretty much still. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. Over the past couple of months, you've been hearing Divided Decade, our year-long project covering the Great Recession and how it continues to affect our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we believe this kind of in-depth reporting helps make people smarter about the economic forces that affect us every single day. If you agree, please go to Marketplace.org to become a Marketplace investor and keep reliable, independent journalism going strong. And thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. A story now for the airline traveling public, of which there is a greater and greater number every year. More passengers on more crowded planes. The House voted back in April to approve the Federal Aviation Administration's reauthorization bill. The Senate has not yet. There are probably going to be changes to ticketing fees and some safety upgrades, but less progress with the air traffic control system, which is under strain because of the aforementioned more and more crowded planes. Marketplace's Renata Sago reports.
Air traffic control is the invisible hand that guides planes on the ground and in the skies. Sharon Pinkerton is with Airlines for America, a lobbying group for commercial airlines.
Air traffic control is really the internet of the skies.
She says the nation's current air traffic control system is safe, but it's in need of a refresh. U.S. passenger numbers hit 965 million last year, an all-time high according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Eric Hansen with the U.S. Travel Association says some flights take longer than they did 15 years ago, and that congestion's one reason, but it's also because
the system that operates today is World War II era technology. It's a radar-based system. Is really holding back the efficiency of aircraft operation.
For decades, commercial air carriers and some lobbying groups have been trying to upgrade the nation's air traffic control system from radar to GPS. So far, the FAA says it's invested $4.7 billion in modernization. But Paul Lewis with the think tank Eno Transportation says it's been slow because, well,
it's a big hurdle to reform anything in government, and this would be a big major reform.
An early House version of the FAA reauthorization bill proposed privatizing the air traffic control system, but that was later removed. The Senate's still working on its version. Congress has extended the deadline for the bill five times so far. The next deadline is at the end of this month. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
There was news this week in the auto tech space, that is, cars and technology, which are becoming closer every single day, it seems. The world's biggest automotive partnership, something called the Renault-Nissan-Mitsubishi Alliance, 10 million cars sold worldwide last year, so it ain't nothing, said it's going to start putting Google's Android operating system in its car starting in 2021. The consumer upside is infotainment systems that do more and are less, buggy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Demanding consumers want a lot of tech in their new cars. Turn-by-turn navigation, music, apps, voice control. And they want those things to just work. But right now,
there still is consumer sentiment that it's not hitting the mark.
And, says Kristen Collage of J.D. Power,
with experiences like voice recognition, we see consumers are quite unhappy with their experience.
And that's because, says Brian Reamer at MIT,
the systems existing in the market are all over the place.
Every car maker does infotainment its own way. In this deal, cars from Nissan, Renault, and Mitsubishi would use Google's Maps, music app, voice assistant, and many other apps. It would be a more deluxe version of the more limited Android Auto, and the alliance says iPhones will work with the new systems. By outsourcing the infotainment platform across models, says Reamer.
Now, there's also substantial savings to the manufacturers because their development costs should, in theory, go down to some degree.
And better tech can help sell more cars, says Gary Silberg at KPMG.
Especially with younger buyers, the technological prowess of a vehicle is very, very important to the buying decision.
Silberg says this deal could open the door for other big tech firms like Apple, which no doubt would also like to be more present in our cars. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The word nerd can be a jab or a poke, usually used in a gently ribbing kind of way. Or it can be a self-descriptor, worn proudly, to denote expertise or proficiency. NerdWallet, the company, uses it that second way, a one-stop site for financial expertise and advice. Tim Chen is the co-founder and CEO. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I have to tell you, we were in a meeting this morning, and we were talking about some of the stuff that's coming up. And I said, well, I'm talking to Tim Chen of NerdWallet here in a couple hours. And like three or four of the millennials in the room went, oh, wow, NerdWallet. Yeah, I know that company, which I thought was interesting that that was the gut reaction of that segment of the audience.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We reach 100 million people a year, but predominantly are known by millennials.
Do me a favor, would you, and tell me why this economy needs this company right now?
Yeah, money is complicated. You know,
yes, it is, man.
It is. And, you know, the thing that we try to do is we try to make it easier. I mean, by the time you have your first kid, you probably have 10, 12 different financial accounts. And how do you know that they're the best ones? So it's hard to stay organized and keep your budgets and all that stuff. So we try to help with those things.
Give me the origin story, would you, about how this company came to be?
Sure. You know, NerdWallet started as a spreadsheet. So my sister asked me for help finding a credit card, and I thought, I wonder what the answer to that is. And so my first thought was, let me Google that for you. So I was kind of surprised by what I found. I mean, it was a lot of marketing material, not much financial analysis the way I would think to do it. You know, I'd been working in finance at the time, so I expected something like a spreadsheet. And so I quickly pulled together all the credit card offers from the biggest banks, and it got forwarded to a few friends. They forwarded it to a few more friends, and that's kind of how it started. Over time, we branched out into more products than just credit cards. So things like personal loans, savings accounts, CDs, but pretty much the same problem. It's just hard to figure out apples and oranges.
Which, and this is deeply, deeply cynical, but one has to imagine that the apples and oranges and hard to figure out thing is somewhat a feature of the system if you're a financial professional, not a bug.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, banks, their core business is building a relationship with you, often through something like a checking account, and then selling you more of their own products over time. And the products they have might not be as good as products you can find on the internet. Millennials are just used to comparing things. Even college professors, that's the one that really strikes me as an older millennial. Yeah, people don't really take college courses anymore without reading the ratings on their professors and figuring out which ones are good and which ones to avoid. Kind of mind-blowing.
That's kind of great, actually. That's a really good analogy. I want to do a very quick circle around to you and where you came from before you started this company and I do it in light of the fact that we're coming off the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers. You're a hedge fund guy, right, who lost his job in the financial crisis.
Yeah, I spent my prior career as an investor analyzing which technology companies were going to succeed and which ones were going to fail, and, you know, betting our investors' money based on those hypotheses.
And how much do you think of your business success now is because people are scarred, I suppose, by that crisis that cost you your job?
Yeah, I do think that crisis had a big impact on the public's faith in some of the largest banking institutions out there. And I think it was concurrent with some other factors, such as, you know, this millennial shift towards offline to online and wanting reviews on everything. So I think those two factors really caused people to do things like comparison shop more actively and think a little bit more cynically about trusting everything that a broker or an advisor or a banker was telling them.
Tim Chen, co-founder and CEO of NerdWallet. Tim, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
There's a whole lot more of my interview with Tim Chen, including his time on the advisory board for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, until he wasn't. It's on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, the perhaps definitive answer to President Trump's question, what was Nike thinking, after that Colin Kaepernick ad came out today. Thomson Reuters did the data. Nike sold out of 61% more items in the 10 days after that ad dropped than in the 10 days before. Quantitative analysis. There you go. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 158 today, 0.6%. NASDAQ down 6, less than 0.1%. Fundamentally flat. S&P 500 up 3 points, about 0.1%. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.